Dr. Nafees Ahmed is a transdisciplinary academic, investigative journalist, and system theorist who's also the author of the already best-selling book, a title that's fresh off the press, The Alt-Reich, The Network War to Destroy the West from Within. Dr. Ahmed, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Important distinction regarding the title of the book. No, I didn't pronounce alt-right in a funny, pretentious way. It is supposed to be Reich, right? Like the German Reich, since the movement that you write about in the book has many far-right and straight-up Nazi underpinnings, which we'll discuss later on. But before we do, and since it's still pretty fresh, do you think that was a Nazi salute that we saw from Elon Musk at Trump's inauguration rally? Or can we chuck it up to, as some of his defenders claim, and I can't believe I'm even saying this, autism?
So it's interesting because after having written this book, which makes the case that there has been a undercurrent of Nazi eugenics influence on the right wing increasingly, and the far right. And I think the case I make is that this is increasingly mainstream and normalized. And that's something I think is pretty well documented. So when, you know, it's kind of unbelievable to see what we saw. It's the inauguration in the United States, and you have a senior official who some people are calling the co-president of the United States because of his massive influence.
The first buddy,
stands
right?
There and he does what, by any standard, appears to be not just one Nazi salute, but two Nazi salutes. I think, people have actually analyzed the physical characteristics of what he did. And I believe that it's, what is clear is that what he actually did were Nazi salutes. I mean, we can always debate the intentionality, why he did those movements. But when you actually play back videos of Nazis who do Nazi salutes, he did exactly what they do. So the physical movements were perfectly mimicked, authentic traditional Nazi salute. And no wonder that actual neo-Nazis and far-right kind of political activists were celebrating, universally. We got this Nazi energy on the global stage in the seat of the American presidency. Fantastic. So I think that gives us an indication of that's what it looked like. And for us to point that out is not delusional. I'm firmly of the belief that if someone shows you who they are, you believe them, So that's my take on it. But I think the other kind of way to think about it is, I don't want to get into all this stuff about, is it autism or all of that stuff. I mean, this is all kind of just, we're getting into strange territory there. I think, let's just look at what he's actually done. Now that he's bought X, what has he actually done on that platform? And again, the record speaks for itself. He has amplified and enabled and reenacted neo-Nazi accounts and websites. He brought back into activity anti-Semitic accounts, Holocaust denial accounts, neo-Nazi accounts, white supremacist accounts. Even in when it came to the far right riots in Britain that happened last year, people who were egging those riots on, people like Paul Golding, who is a former member of former leader in the BNP, the British National Party, which is a notorious neo-Nazi group, Holocaust-denying, anti-Semitic. This group is well-known, and yet Paul Golding was amplified by Elon Musk. Elon Musk has actually come out and commented on and amplified anti-Semitic comments. There was one it became famous because people were reporting on it, but there was a well-known, there was a quite widely read comment posted by an anti-Semitic account saying that, the Jews are involved in a conspiracy to import immigrants at scale into the West, and this is a threat to the white race. And he replied to that, and you know, he said that this is you know, I can't remember exact words he used, but he endorsed the tweet. So you just have to judge that, you know, like look at Nick Fuentes is another notorious far right activist, Holocaust denier, misogynist. You know, just find all the pejoratives you can, add them all up, and I think he is them. You know, he was allowed back onto Twitter. He's been amplified, and he was actually celebrating the Nazi salutes that Elon Musk appeared to do. So I don't actually care whether he knowingly did a Nazi salute or didn't. What is absolutely clear, though, is that Elon Musk has been following and amplifying neo-Nazi accounts. He's been reading this material. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's been radicalizing himself by his own platform and found it within himself that doing that movement just made perfect sense. Whether he personally decided that this was a Nazi loot or didn't decide it was Nazi, it was actually kind of besides the point. I'm more concerned about the fact that no one is talking about how he has been, and this platform has been weaponizing, you know, kind of neo-Nazi and anti-Semitic sentiment ever since Elon Musk purchased it. And this is the real issue. Judging a person by their actions, Elon Musk is a Nazi sympathizer. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And the Nazi salute that he did, or apparently did, you know, fits into that pattern. So I just wonder, where are we, where this is a debate that we have to have? I mean, this is just a really strange place for us to be.
Yeah, it doesn't help that people are trying to explain it away by saying also that it was a Roman salute. And of course, the Nazi salute was inspired by the Roman salute. So I don't know what we did there. Also, it didn't help that after his saluting, he virtually appeared at the AfD conference and gave a speech there. So within this context, it's exactly like you said, if people show you who they are, you better believe them, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, the Roman salute thing is, you know, if you look it up, I mean, the Roman salute itself is kind of an invention. You know, there was no actual Roman salute. It's got no historical basis. So it's a modern thing that was associated with modern fascism. You know, so again, it's just like the question we need to ask is that Elon Musk is not a stupid person. We all agree that. We all know that. Why did he choose to do that? Why did he choose to make an action at this critical time, which sent a signal to neo-Nazis everywhere? And then, you know, when he didn't even deny it, he actually just mocked the Holocaust and mocked, you know, he made Holocaust jokes, you know, using the names of Nazi war criminals like Goebbels and Himmler, and made some jokes about it, you know, it's all a big joke, you know, to the point that the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which, you know, tried to kind of call for calm and said, look, maybe these are not Nazi salutes, even they came out and said, whoa, why are you making jokes about the Holocaust and this is not something to joke about. And so it's obvious that this guy he holds these issues in contempt, you know. And just look at what has happened now with Trump's executive orders and his war on DEI and diversity, equity, and inclusion. One of the things they've done is they've banned people in the military and I think maybe possibly other parts of the government from participating and celebrating Holocaust Memorial Day. As part of a whole raft of other things, but this is what we're up against. I mean, so the experiences of a minority like the Jewish minority, and you know, there's other things that they've gone. They've also attacked Martin Luther King's Day, and things like that. So the experiences of minorities like Black communities, Jewish minorities, you know, these historical experiences are not important anymore. That's the message that we're hearing. Why would you not consider those important? I mean, why does America being great again have to involve not thinking about the Holocaust, you know, and not remembering what happened to millions of, you know, black people who were enslaved? I mean, it's just bizarre and indefensible and makes no sense.
All right, back to your book, which is, I'm not going to lie, quite a dark and heavy, if necessary, read. Speaking of what you term as the alt-Reich, I was surprised that ideologically the whole thing didn't start with the Nazis, but even earlier, and you mentioned it already, with eugenics in the US, which predated even the Nazis. Could you give us a breakdown of these infamous beginnings?
So the book does, it starts in kind of the 1920s, 1930s. And we saw that these ideas about eugenics, which was this pseudoscience, at the time it was considered high science, but we now know that it scientifically doesn't really stand up. But at that time, this was a very common way of seeing the world. Obviously, it was linked up with historical colonization and the very, very kind of hierarchical structures of power that existed at the time. And eugenics was really seen as a way of making sense of that. It kind of justified those hierarchical power structures. It justified the way in which colonization worked. And essentially was the belief that, you know, there was an inherent kind of biological structure to humanity. And that really there wasn't one human race. In a way, there wasn't one human species, that actually there were multiple different races. And these races existed, according to eugenics, in this kind of biological hierarchy. And of course, the science of genetics was emerging at this time and began to feed into this idea that there was this hierarchy. And of course, white people were seen as the pinnacle of this hierarchy, black people largely at the bottom. I think there were some debates about which ethnicities might have been in the middle and, you know, could we move them around sometimes. But generally, that hierarchy was pretty much the way people saw the world. And this predated the rise of the Nazis, but also obviously influenced them heavily. And I think what the book shows is that there was this really alarming kind of cross-communication between American eugenicists in the 30s who were kind of really pushing forward this new, what they felt was a very exciting frontier in science about scientific racism. And they were communicating with Nazi eugenicists and they were sharing ideas. And so even before the Nazis came into government, these ideas were swirling around. And in fact, the Nazi eugenicists took a lot of inspiration from the Americans, you know, where it, and the things that were, even on a legislative level, you know, there were laws that were being passed on immigration, on dealing with black people, sterilization laws, really horrific racial laws. You know, segregation obviously was already there. So the Nazis were looking at this and saying, this is actually great stuff. We should be doing this here in Germany. And so a lot of those ideas were imported into Nazi Germany and actually took shape when the Nazi government was formed, and they were implemented in different ways by the Nazi government. And in turn, the American eugenicists were looking at what was going on in Nazi Germany and saying, wow, you know, these guys are implementing these policies on an industrial scale with huge, huge kind of efficacy. Well, we should do the same here. And so they then imported the things back to America and said, look, let's pass laws in Congress. Let's have sterilization laws here. Let's supercharge the kind of anti-immigrant legislation and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so it became a bit of a kind of vicious cycle in a way, and they fueled each other very much so. And many people aren't aware of that, that actually there was this, right from the very beginning, there was this dialogue going on between the American right wing And this was the mainstream right wing at that time, and Nazi Germany.
That was before the Second World War. And then after the Second World War, it kind of wasn't all that popular going around proclaiming your race to be superior to others. However, as you detail in the book, that didn't mean that these kind of folks didn't try exerting their influence in other ways, sometimes in the guise of so-called scientific inquiry. And one of the most revered works that falls under the banner of pretty much scientific racism appeared in 1994, and that was The Bell Curve by Charles Murray, in which he linked race and intelligence with predictable results, white people being the most intelligent than everyone else. Now, even though the book has been refuted a million times by a number of serious scholars, its appeal among the radical right endures to this day. Why is that?
So this was a really interesting exercise in, and it gives us a sense of why and how we've arrived at where we are today, right? And as you said, rightly, after the Second World War, obviously, to go around in the West saying you're a Nazi was hardly, you wouldn't make many friends at parties, put it that way. So you had to change your approach. So in fact, what we saw happening was a whole bunch of Nazi sympathizers going around actually saying we're not Nazis and we hate Nazis. And this became the defining dynamic of the far right, actually, as it evolved. Increasingly, far right activists were masquerading as anti-Nazi and trying to put themselves forward as we are the most anti-Nazi people ever in the world, despite harboring these kind of very traditional anti-Semitic, racist, eugenics kind of ideas. Now, Charles Murray really kind of exemplifies this. So he came along in the 1990s. His book, The Bell Curve, was based, or the key theories that he put forward about scientific racism were all based on research that was funded by the Pioneer Fund. Now, the Pioneer Fund was a Nazi foundation that was established in the 1930s, before the Second World War, in New York. And it was one of the key conduits between the American right, American eugenicists, and Nazi eugenicists. And it maintained very close connections with Hitler's officials. And in fact, there was a lot of research sharing going on and so forth. Now, the Pioneer Fund continued to exist after the Second World War. And one of the things that they started doing was funding research to support their theories of scientific racism and giving grants to mainstream American universities. Now, all of this was kind of happening underground, like wasn't very well known, didn't have a huge amount of visibility. But even as they were doing that, they began to shift their direction towards really two things: countering communism, because that was the next big enemy on the horizon that you could focus on, and using that to counter the civil rights movement. So that's why we see that there is this intersection. And even at the time, we saw that many of the Republicans were campaigning against civil rights on the basis that the entire civil rights campaign was essentially a kind of a left-wing communist conspiracy to undermine America, infiltrate American society, you know, destroy national security from within, using kind of, you know, race and using racial equality and things like that. So these foundations, these ideas, which, you know, nowadays, you know, we hear about wokeism and culture wars. I mean, the seeds of this were already there, was already happening in the 1960s. So fast forward to, you know, Charles Murray, he publishes this book in 1994 called The Bell Curve. And when you read his book, it really gives away the approach. You know, he praises Henry Laughlin, who was one of the early directors of the Pioneer Fund and an actual Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite. But in this book, he praises him. But he never refers to him as a Nazi, never acknowledges his anti-Semitism, never acknowledges the anti-Semitic roots of all of this research. Instead, just repackages it, talks about it as if he's putting forward this very objective science. And the Bell Curve kind of laid the foundations for this idea. And then what happened then was quite extraordinary. Charles Murray ended up kind of finding himself in all sorts of mainstream right-wing spaces, pushing forward these ideas. And on the back of this eugenics model, he basically said that welfare kind of economics of any kind where it's believed that the state should have some responsibility for disadvantaged citizens. This should be dispensed with. And the reason it should be dispensed with is because the stratification of society is not due to the system, it's due to biology. Biology and genetics, primarily, along with some environmental factors, but has created this, what he called this cognitive stratification of society. So in other words, because there are these racial hierarchies in intelligence, that is why we have inequalities. That is why we have predominantly poor people are black and ethnic and maybe Muslim and all the rest of it. And that is why society has these structures. So rather than kind of throwing money at these people, we should be actually trying to contain them, manage them, and really just depopulate them, really kind of reduce their numbers in some way. And that was essentially the political program that he was offering. And this made a lot of sense to the traditional right wing. It was like, well, actually, that makes sense. We want to have deregulated states, you know, deregulated economies. We want freedom for capital. We don't want to be investing too much money in all of this stuff. And we want to kind of, you know, we think these existing structures as they exist should really be maintained. And we should be putting more money into the productive classes rather than into these unproductive kind of areas. So that made a lot of sense. And so Charles Murray ended up influencing, you know, Reaganomics. His ideas even influenced Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton implemented welfare regulation on the basis of Charles Murray's ideas. Charles Murray was flown over to the UK by Rupert Murdoch. He wrote some articles in the Sunday Times about the underclass in Britain and the problem of the underclass. These ideas were shared with the Institute for Economic Affairs, which was one of the biggest right-wing think tanks in the UK. Also became very, very prominent in calling for Britain to leave the European Union most recently. And Charles Murray also met Number 10. He had a bunch of meetings with Margaret Thatcher, Number 10 policy officials, you know, the finance departments, the treasury. He was a darling of the British establishment, of the American right-wing establishment. And since then, his ideas have kind of seeped into mainstream discourse and have kind of, you know, by stealth have smuggled in this eugenics ideology. So a lot of people don't realize that the very strong neoliberal, neoclassical economic theories that we have are kind of married to this kind of eugenics undertones. And they work together and they reinforce each other.
Oof, makes sense. These days, it's kind of exhausting to keep up with these lads. Well, it's mostly lads, but not exclusively, because they seem to be inventing kind of like a new grievance, a new conspiracy theory every week, even though these theories, as they call them, theories, are usually totally contradicting each other. Now, one of the most popular ones is the so-called Great Replacement Theory, which until I read your book, I honestly never even heard of. Could you tell us what that's supposed to be?
Sure, of course. So the Great Replacement Theory is an increasingly popular theory that's been put out by a number of far-right writers. You can trace it back to many, many different kind of writers in America, in Europe. But it kind of took on that formal, but it got its name from someone called Renaud Camus, I believe his name is. He's a French author. And he actually used that specific term, the Great Replacement. And it's this idea that essentially there's some sort of grand conspiracy from outside. It might be driven by Islamists. It might be driven by European Union. It might be driven by European kind of a cabal of evil kind of lefties and liberals. But somehow there's this conspiracy to basically import millions of migrants, largely from the Muslim world, but overwhelmingly dark-skinned, into Europe to replace white people. And it's, obviously on its face, when you say it like that, you're kind of thinking, what? What are you talking about? And so that's the general idea that there that's the fundamental challenge that we have. Now, this idea was fringe maybe say 15 years ago, but has increasingly become normalized. And it's actually inspired terrorist attacks. So if we remember the 2011 mass murder of Norwegians by Anders Breivik.
Yeah.
Yes, the convicted neo-Nazi terrorist, white supremacist. Now, he was someone who was really inspired by this idea of a great replacement. And he referred to the theory in his manifesto. And when journalists were analyzing that manifesto, they realized that the kind of the ingredients of this idea were not just contained to these fringe elements, but they were being promoted by people in the United States, people like Robert Spencer, who is a very anti-Muslim theologian. He's been talking about ideas like this. Daniel Pipes, who is a national security type scholar, but considers himself a scholar of the Middle East, an expert in the Middle East. He runs this thing called the Middle East Forum. There's a bunch of these different people in America, but also being picked up in the UK and parts of Europe by different elements. Now, the funny thing about the Great Replacement theory is that it's obviously there's no evidence whatsoever that there's any conspiracy of such kind taking place. There's no evidence whatsoever that there's an influx on this scale even happening. We do know that there have been large influxes of immigrants that happened at specific times. So for instance, in the wake of the Syria war, there was obviously this collapse of Syria. We had multiple simultaneous theaters, Iraq, Syria, just on the back of the Arab Spring chaos as well. So there was many parts of the region were in chaos. And at that time, most of the people who were coming to Europe's shores were actually coming from the Syria conflict. You know, there was something like 1 million people, I think, at some point in 1 year, who were coming. So we know that there is an issue going on here. But we can clearly trace that back to, major geopolitical shifts rather than some sort of, kind of attempt to kind of replace white people. And I think, the way what they've done is they've said is this immigration thing is also working as a part of a plan to increase the population of these migrants inside the Europe so that we can take over. And I think when you actually look at the statistics on that, people are saying, even recently there's been stuff coming out from GB News here in the UK, for instance, which is a right-wing kind of broadcaster, putting out these ideas. And, they're saying stuff like Muslims are going to take over the British population, they're going to potentially become 50% of the population or even dominate the population within the next 20 to 30 years and all of this inflammatory stuff. And all the demographic experts who are looking at this saying, look, yes, there is going to be population growth of specifically the Muslim population if we're going to look specifically there. And it's something like maybe will rise by about 10% over the next 30, 40 years or something like that. And so, yes, there is a population rise, but it's nothing like what is being claimed. And there's obviously other populations which are also growing. Is this something that as societies we should be looking at? Should we be having policies about this? Should we be thinking about it, making good decisions? Absolutely. Should we be discussing immigration laws and how to manage immigration? Absolutely. No one is saying don't talk about these things, don't think about how to manage these issues in our society. But is there a catastrophic great replacement going on? No, this is total bullshit. But yet this has become increasingly normal mainstream. The Trump administration, or so many of people in the Trump administration believe this and has been saying this, and it's how they got into power. They used this narrative to get into power. They were saying that it's in the swing states in America. They were saying the Democrats are importing immigrants and they're gonna get voting rights and all of this stuff, and it was all completely false. If you look at the data on immigration to all those swing states, immigration has been either the same or actually declining for the data that we have over a 4-year period, the last kind of data that we've got. So what we have is a very deliberate effort to weaponize these ideas, to fearmonger in order to control us and actually compel populations to move in a certain direction.
And who's supposed to be leading this incredible operation? Is it like a revolving door of villains like George Soros, or is it specific populations?
It's all sorts of things. It's everybody, you know. So that's what's interesting, right? So you've got this kind of interesting conspiracy between people like George Soros, people like, you know, who's supposed to be some sort of he's painted as, obviously he's ethnically Jewish, and so he's painted so the anti-Semitic undertones are there. He's painted as part of this globalist conspiracy. To do this, also part, you know, you've got the European Union, you know, and kind of the liberal establishment, European Union governments are doing this. At the same time, it's Islamists, so Islamist kind of Sharia law toting totalitarians are also doing this. So somehow, you've got the Jews, lefty Jews and liberals, and of course, you know, the liberals who are. They want us to be LGBTQ+. They want us to be gender fluid, and they want us to be trans. So all of those guys are working in cahoots with the totalitarian, gay-hating Islamists who want to destroy democracy. And they're all working with the European Union. And all of this is happening, and they're all part of the same conspiracy, and they're all trying to come and send these Islamists in to replace white people, because I mean, what else is there to do, right? I mean, just replace white people. That's it. That makes perfect sense. I mean, it's nonsense. There's no actual logic to this idea. It's just crazy.
Yeah, that's a really tight story. No holds there. Yes. I mean, all of this stuff, listening to you, like the great replacement theory, and then you also have cultural Marxism, the Muslim Brotherhood running things, you know, Jewish control, is such an obvious kind of dumpster fire of nonsensical racist paranoia. However, what I do want to know is, what's the ideological base under all of this, the sort of like underpinning that's holding all of these wacky strands together?
So it's important to be clear that there isn't any kind of unifying, kind of heterogeneous, single ideology that's driving this. What we have is an evolving movement and an evolving network, which is, I should say there isn't a homogeneous, sorry, there's not a homogeneous ideology. So the movement and the network is very heterogeneous, which essentially means, you know, it's quite diverse. You know, the people disagree with each other a lot. They emphasize different things. So it's important to look at this from a kind of a network point of view, rather than seeing it as some sort of conspiracy driven by one like cabal. What I think has happened is, on the one hand, you have a core nexus of Nazi sympathizers, you know, white supremacists who, you know, right from day one, you know, kind of really, really bought the Nazi ideology and wanted to export it. Now, that they themselves have also kind of evolved. They've gone through their own kind of process, adapting their ideas. But fundamentally, the core of it is still very, very similar. And we can see that core when we look at the bell curve. And it gives us that sense of, you know, there's cognitive stratification, eugenics, there's a hierarchy, there's a racial biological hierarchy. So that ideology, these guys have been making a deliberate effort to attempt to bring that ideology into mainstream spaces. They have been trying to indoctrinate people. They have been trying to radicalize people. And they have had some success. So what's happened is that they've been moving into these political spaces, whether it's political parties, whether it's institutions and think tanks, and laundering their ideas. As they've been doing that, they've had mixed success. Some people have gravitated to these ideas and taken them on. They don't necessarily know the Nazi origins of the ideas, but they've said, it makes sense to me that there is a biological stratification of society. Actually, I believe that. So they'll believe that. They won't realize that this is scientifically ridiculous and not grounded in anything but originating from Nazi ideology. And they won't even necessarily know that many of the people who've been pushing these ideas have these Nazi connections. They won't realize that some of these people actually work with the Nazi Pioneer Fund, which still exists today, and in fact has now been rehabilitated. It has a new name. It's called the Human Diversity Foundation. And, you know, because they think humans are diverse and there's multiple human races, essentially. But interesting that they use that language, right? So that's they've had that rehabilitation process. And there are people who are intersecting with that network still, and they have connections with that network, and they're listening to their ideas. So people who have taken on those ideas, some of them might know that there is this white supremacist Nazi element to it, and some of them might not. And so in a way, that's useful, because many of those who don't know will continue to write about it. They'll continue to push these ideas and push the consequences of those ideas in different forums. And so the more it gets pushed out, the less obvious it is that there is this kind of link. There's this kind of fundamental logical and intellectual framing that originates in eugenics ideology. They'll just take the remnants of it. And the remnants of it are, if we believe that, then surely we shouldn't have immigration of inferior people to this country. But because the framing becomes, let's frame it in terms of culture. So that's where you get the tactical shift. So you get the Nigel Farages of the world, you know, the Nick Griffin, you know, Nigel Farage, who is head of the Reform Party, head of a kind of one of the main right-wing parties in the UK. Many would say they're very far right. There's, you know, Nick Griffin from the BNP party. And of course, you have others as well, like, you know, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, you know, Marine Le Pen in France, the Austrian FPO. All these different parties that got slightly different approaches, right? But they've converged on this idea that, well, you know, there's a cultural problem of Muslims. And sometimes they'll talk about the ethnic problem. You know, Wilders will come out and say, there's too many Moroccans. You know, don't have a problem with ethnic Moroccans. And then when he's pushed, he'll say, well, it's, you know, it's the Muslim ideology that they bring in. It's the Quran. We should ban the Quran. And he'll focus on religion. But what they've done by framing it as it's a cultural and religious issue, they try to escape the strictures of anti-racist legislation and try to escape being labeled as racist. But what they're actually saying is that these groups of inferior people out there who are biologically race kind of inferior in some way, and that's consistent anyway, even if those guys don't believe that, it's consistent and it's been pushed forward by kind of more eugenics ideology. So you've got this idea that, well, those guys are inferior. Well, how does that inferiority manifest? Well, it manifests civilizationally in these regressive cultures, regressive values, regressive ideas. That's why they're all terrible. And so we can't have them here. And so we don't have any soul searching about, well, what were the impacts of the way in which the global system evolved? Why are there these deep-seated structural kind of, you know, kind of ruptures between the global north and the global south, or the west and the east? What explains those things? It's much easier for these guys to say, oh, that's just because they're just them, and they're just terrible, and they're just bad, and they're just inferior in the way that they are. It's their culture, it's their ideas, it's their biology, whatever it is, it's just them. Rather than saying maybe there was a, you know, maybe colonization does have a role to play. You know, and I think, you know, a nuanced analysis would say that would say, of course, that there are issues in these countries which they have to, you know, people in those countries have to take responsibility as well for things that are going on in those countries. It's not right to say everything is the fault of the West or everything is the fault of Europe. But a nuanced conversation will acknowledge that history has consequences, and that there were these big structural realities that created these dynamics that made it much more likely that with lack of resources, lack of access, very deeply unequal systems of exchange, that did leave countries, many countries in Africa, the impact of slavery and so forth. Of course, it left them in a very, very disadvantaged position, which meant that most nefarious people and corrupt people have had a chance to kind of exploit the system. And of course, many Western governments and institutions have been complicit as well in that. I mean, this is not controversial. So I think that's the reality is that what these people are doing is trying to avoid engaging in that complexity and just simplify it and say the problem is just them out there and that's what we have to deal with.
The surprising twist for a movement or a network that keeps alleging shadowy control literally behind every fart is the fact that most of these think tanks and organizations are funded and spearheaded by a bunch of notable billionaires, usually quite openly. So not exactly a popular peasant revolt, all this, is it?
Yes, exactly. It's a really absolutely great point. Just follow the money is a way the way I would put it. You know, if you're have a look at the think tanks, have a look at the institutions that are putting this out. And I would urge people to take a step back and say, wait a minute, I'm reading this in the Telegraph. Who owns the Telegraph? I'm reading this in the Daily Mail. Who owns the Daily Mail? I'm reading this, I'm watching this on GB News. Who owns GB News? GB News, by the way, is owned by and was set up and founded by a guy called Christopher Chandler, who's a billionaire. Who made his fortune from basically helping to save Gazprom, Russia's state-owned energy company, from collapse back in the decades ago, and worked very closely with senior Russian officials, including one of Putin's closest advisors today. So who is this guy? What's going on? If we look at the institutions that are pummeling this stuff out that I've mentioned, look at the Heritage Foundation. Look at, you know, in conservative Washington think tank. Look at the Institute for Economic Affairs. Look at the Atlas Network, this network of 500-odd free market think tanks all over the world putting forward these sorts of ideas. Who funds them? The Koch industries, you know, that, you know, you've got that's just one fossil fuel. You've got all of these kind of the Mellon industries. You know, they were a big banking industrial kind of family. You've got all of the major kind of philanthropic organizations that are financing these groups come from largely billionaire families in the United States that have made most of their money out of the fact that they own and control some of the most important industries in America. And these are often fossil fuel industries, automotive industries, even kind of some of the manufacturing industries and so on and so forth. Now, increasingly, what's come into that space and made it even more disruptive is the technology oligarchy. It's the people who have made the most recent money, the tech platforms, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, of course, Peter Thiel. Now, a lot of these folks, you know, Mark Andreessen, a lot of these folks who are in technology, they own the big platforms and things like that. These guys are now massive players on a similar level to the other big oligarchy that we had, you know, in fossil fuels and things like that. And these guys are now pouring money also, not just into those think tanks, but into many other initiatives.
Speaking of billionaires, the darling champion of the far right now is, of course, Donald Trump, yet again. In the book, you detail how in the middle of the resurgence of these ideas, again, in 2010s, one of the most successful propagandists of the alt-Reich, Steve Bannon, who was actively looking for a suitable presidential candidate at the time, they were looking for an outsider that would propel the movement into the mainstream. And then he obviously found him. But I'm curious as to why do you think they went with this extremely unpleasant former reality TV show star who, as Scottish comedian Frankie Boyle once put it, looks like someone playing a president in a porno. I mean, what did they see in Trump?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I think this speaks to, in a way, the effectiveness of the analytical techniques using information tools that the right wing and the far right are now using. So the first thing that kind of informed their decision to go for Trump was polling, which was very simple, really. But they did. There was some polling that was done, which showed that both Americans, both Democrat and Republican, were extremely disillusioned and wanted kind of like an outsider kind of candidate to come in. and shake things up. So at that point, Steve Bannon and the Mercers, who actually at the, as I reveal in my book, at the David Horowitz Freedom Center annual Restoration Weekend, which is a far-right gathering that's been taking place for many years. And David Horowitz, if your listeners are not aware, is a very well-known far-right anti-black activist. He's actually extremely racist, constantly talking about black people in generalized terms being terrible and taking over things and all of this stuff. So in any case, they did this polling, and Steve Bannon was already kind of aware of Donald Trump at the time. And presumably they looked at who he was, I think, and the fact that he had this already kind of like an interesting kind of popularity at that time. You know, he was quite well known. He was on TV. He was entertaining. And people didn't really know what his political views were that much at the time, right? Or he kind of felt like this could be like an empty vessel situation. You know, we can push him in the direction we want. And I think they realized that there was an opportunity to resonate with, specifically with, the disenfranchised elements of the Republican base. And also to pull people who were traditionally voting Democrats into that by weaponizing sentiment. And that's where, you know, the role of things like Cambridge Analytica came in. You know, Cambridge Analytica, which was the very well-known kind of tech profiling analytics platform, you know, set up by Bannon with funding from the Mercers. They set up in America. They also set up in London. And they essentially created profiles of voters, both in the UK in relation to Brexit and also in the US, you know, like something like tens of millions of American voters on Facebook, and developed a way of targeting them according to their emotional state of being. So this was quite a sophisticated operation. We don't know, we can't empirically prove how successful or not successful that approach was, because the data is just opaque. I think it's inherently impossible to prove, really, you know, what actually happened. We just don't know. But what we do know is that those techniques were used, and clearly they were used with considerable success. You know, they used this to inform a new form of what I might say, you might call it information warfare, where you're targeting specific individuals across populations to compel them to make political decisions in a certain direction. And a lot of the techniques they were using, we're now seeing these, you know, after Cambridge Analytica collapsed, those techniques have become widely used everywhere. And now we're seeing them used on X by Elon Musk quite openly on a grand scale. And we've seen there's been studies which have looked at the way in which things have worked on X. And they've found that there's been a major algorithmic shift, you know, that all the evidence points to a major algorithmic shift. So X has now become kind of a political tool of information warfare and is now being used to kind of just weaponize outrage. And I think that's been the strategy so far, is to weaponize outrage specifically to target, these different sectors of the population that they think are going to resonate with a right wing and a far right agenda.
Do you think that the billionaires who are running this charade, who are funding all of these think tanks, are just cynically playing the game, so to speak, so promoting these narratives to further destroy the power of the state and push for deregulation just to line their pockets further? Or do they actually believe some of this stuff? What I'm asking is, at the end of the day, is it all about money?
So it's difficult to tell. I mean, what we can see is that there's been a consistent pattern of these ideas becoming more mainstream and very powerful people intersecting with them and kind of amplifying them. So we know Elon Musk, for instance, we've already talked about how he's been weaponizing kind of neo-Nazi accounts. And as part of that, he's also been amplifying directly, accounts which are promoting scientific racism, You know, he's been commenting on them. He's been signal boosting them. That might suggest on its face that he believes them. He actually thinks these ideas are true. Peter Thiel has also been intersecting with these ideas. So, for instance, we know that he has flown out kind of pro-eugenicist far-right activists who are linked to Mankind Quarterly, which is a journal that was published by the Nazi-aligned Pioneer Fund. There's been credible reports. I mean, Max Chafkin, the Bloomberg reporter, in his biography of Peter Thiel, wrote that Peter Thiel has funded, gave seed funding to a publication called Quillette. And Quillette is widely recognized as an attempt to repackage discredited race science in a new way and to kind of get it more amplified. So we see these intersections there. The question, of course, is, do they really believe those specific ideas, or are they just using these ideas to divide and rule? And I think for us, ultimately, we don't know the answer to that, but I think we have to just take things at face value to some extent. I think my concern is that the more that you keep kind of finding yourselves entertaining these ideas, the more you're going to end up essentially beginning to believe them, and the more they become mainstream in your mind. So that's the danger, is that you might start playing with these ideas and weaponizing them and using them to divide and rule populations. But then more and more people start believing them, and then it gets to a point where you start believing the same things that you're actually promoting.
What do you think is the ultimate aim of the alt-right?
So there's lots of different aims amongst different groups of people in the alt-right, you know, so different. They have different agendas. Some of them are very focused on wanting to deregulate capital, you know, which is much more aligned with some of what the technology guys want. Technology guys are very concerned about all these efforts to regulate the tech platforms. They don't want to be told that you need to, you know, worry about harms and kind of have kind of fact checking and stuff like that. You know, so that's one kind of obvious thing. You know, if you're looking at other kind of elements of it might be focused on, let's, you know, for instance, fossil fuels. You know, we want to kind of keep fossil fuels going. We don't want to have this clean energy stuff. But that's just to give an example. You have different elements looking at different things. Other people are focused on the transgender debate. You know, the thing that really motivates them is transgender. That's the thing that we have to worry about. For other people, it's abortion. You know, we have to focus on that. But what's increasingly uniting these people is the shared ideologies that are emerging. So more and more of people who are having these different agendas, they're latching onto the great replacement view. And they're finding that that's the kind of a shared way of seeing the challenge. That all of these different views begin to kind of cohere around the idea, also the cultural Marxism view, you know, the idea that there are these liberal left-wing conspiracies often run by Jewish people or Jewish-linked institutions, you know, but often they will take out, because they don't want to be labeled anti-Semite, they'll take out the Jewish part and they'll say, oh, it's just liberal. And, you know, they're fighting culture wars to destroy Western civilization as it stands, that kind of thing. So I think that's the problem, is that they're all kind of cohering. But I think that where that shared ideology begins to land in terms of one singular goal that I think they've begun to converge on is the simple idea that democracy in its current form, liberal democracy in its current form, is over and is the problem and needs to be taken down and totally re-engineered in some way. And they're moving toward this idea that we need a much more authoritarian political structure in power, and that is the solution.
Fantastic. With Trump's decisive victory, the far right is riding high at the moment. However, some cracks within MAGA did appear almost immediately after his inauguration, notably the split between Elon Musk and the hardcore MAGA supporters when it comes to visas for foreign tech workers. Do you think this is an early taste of the things to come?
Well, as I said, because the alt-right is very heterogeneous, because there are different views and different approaches, we're going to increasingly see, as they attempt to implement their agenda, they're going to create all of these conflicts. They're going to create all of these fractures. Those fissures and fractures are going to increasingly worsen. And so here we have an opportunity to kind of leverage that, to kind of fight back, and also to expose what these people really believe. So I think that's going to be a thing that we're going to see in the future. Like, I mean, with this strange kind of conflict that emerged between Musk and Bannon, you know, they're arguing over the visa thing. So again, it was so weird. You know, Elon Musk, you could see the kind of eugenics thinking in his ideas, where he was like, we're going to use these visas to bring in more productive workers from foreign workers, because American workers are retarded. And someone wrote this and he basically agreed with it. American workers are retarded, and you can't train retarded people to be not retarded. And that's a very eugenics idea, right? That cognitively, if you're inferior and you don't have what it takes, you know, that's it. That's just who you are. It's where you're at. But he used that to justify his idea of, well, let's bring some other more clever, cognitively clever people from abroad to recompense that. And Steve Bannon, who's also a racist, you know, and also said a lot of racist things, said, no, Elon Musk, you're racist, and we need to just ban all immigration completely. So you have two racists effectively fighting with each other about the modality of racism that they want to implement. Now, I think Elon Musk backed down because Steve Bannon literally said that, I'm going to rip your face off. You know, so that's how visceral this was going to get. So he backed down because he realized that he didn't want to fracture the movement right now. But this is going to be something that is going to exist and continue to be there, you know, in months and years to come. And there's a question over how coherent. I mean, this ideology is not coherent. That's the whole thing. It's not a coherent ideology. It's a mess. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think it can actually work.
Last question. Despite these kind of scuffles in general, the far right seems to be incredibly unified somehow. However, the mainstream left is as fragmented, clueless, and lost as ever. I saw a great post on Instagram today where somebody wrote the following: the Democrats turned the party of the working class into the party of consultants, defense contractors, and Davos divas. They refuse to declare a climate emergency, refuse to condemn the billionaire class, refuse to utter the word genocide, let alone stop it. The Democrats ran as MAGA light, so people chose the real thing. What does the mainstream left need to do to turn this catastrophic run around?
So that's a massive question. But I think we need to basically, on the one hand, understand what we're up against. I think the left is deeply confused. They do not really understand what we're up against. They're focused on narrow myopic things, and they don't realize what is at stake. That leads us to the next thing. So the first part, I think, is really getting an understanding of what this network is, how it operates, what their agenda is, what they're about, and really understanding what is at stake. Because what is at stake is exactly that. It's the fundamentals of democracy. This is a network war. That's why that's the subtitle of my book. It's an offensive on the foundations of democracy as it stands today. And one of the reasons they're doing it is because there's a systemic crisis in energy, in environment, in the economy, and these guys want to clamp down and maintain even more authoritarian structures to maintain power and wealth. Having understood that, we need to realize that we need to get better at communicating this to publics in ways which are really simple and easy to understand. But even more importantly, we have to start creating an alternative vision that people can buy into, and one that is based on systemic transformation. And I think that critique of the Democrats that you read out is spot on, that we were in a weird situation where voters were able to look at Trump, who had just been voted out. You know, and then they voted Biden in, and then, you know, now they've gone swung back to Trump. And so I think we're in this era of swing politics where we're swinging from kind of like this tepid liberal orthodoxy, which kind of is trying to keep this broken system going along. And the other alternative, which is what the far right is saying, which is, let's just tear it all down, tear down the so-called deep state, the administrative state. And of course, they're not really tearing down deep state. They're just replacing certain structures and systems and putting their own people in there, making it even more homogeneous, just so they can pursue a very specific agenda. That's not democratic. It's the complete opposite. So what we need to do, what the left needs to do, and people on the right who do not buy into the far right, we need to create a new way of seeing things which embraces the urgency and necessity of systemic transformation, fundamental systemic transformation, not tinkering around with the system, but really changing things at scale, and doing it by leveraging the amazing things that are happening today, whether it is in clean energy, you know, whether it is in, you know, kind of amazing new things happening in food, whether, you know, taking on board some of the best advice that we've got coming from cutting edge economics on how we rethink you know, the kind of massive wealth inequalities and the way in which GDP has been used in a narrow way, and start thinking about different metrics, apply different ways, you know, and start investing in productive infrastructure, you know, in a way that makes sense, rather than getting caught into the trap of saying, oh, we're going to invest in, you know, old industries which are dying and stuff like that, which is essentially what we're seeing now, which I think is such a sad thing. Trump's like, I'm going to drill, I'm going to do all this stuff. And it's like, one of the themes of the book is this idea of energy return on investment, which says that the amount of energy that you've put into a resource to get out energy is actually increasing. So we're putting more energy in to get less energy out. And this is an objective empirical measure that has been used to assess fossil fuels. And all the studies show that the EROI value of fossil fuels over the last decades has massively declined. And this plays a big role in why there is a cost of living crisis and why there's a crisis of inflation. It's not just about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That's been an amplifier, and it's been a trigger which has put the system into a tailspin. But the underlying issues are these deeper, bigger energy economic issues, which are obviously intertwined with climate change, intertwined with other things. Those are the big issues that we're not dealing with. The problem with people like Trump, Farage, and others is that their agenda is not going to work. It's going to fail. But that's also what we need to remember, was that as those things fail, and they are going to fail, like all the crazy things Trump is going to do, you know, he wants to, you know, deport 20 million migrants, and all the studies show that, you know, that's not the thing that's, you know, that's not the problem with the economy. You're going to take out 7.5% of GDP. You know, that's on a conservative basis, right? No one is saying, you know, maybe we should tighten things up. Maybe we should do better. Maybe we should make sure that there are more ways of getting migrants documented, making sure they're paying tax, making sure they're building jobs. You know, yeah, that all that kind of stuff. That no one's saying don't do that. But just throwing out 20 million undocumented migrants, you're going to destroy your economy. That's just a fact. Is migration actually, is that the real problem in the economy? Is that the thing? All the evidence shows that this idea that it's immigration that is the problem in the economy is actually not grounded in fact. It's again, it's an ideology. So there is an opportunity for us here on the left, when these things fail, that people are going to be like, what is the alternative? What is the answer? What do we do? They need to have those ideas ready to pick up, say, that's what we need to do. That's the answer. I understand why these people failed. They failed because they're the alt-right, and this is what the systemic solution is. Let's go for it. So, you know, we've got our work cut out, but it's the only way forward.
Or maybe George Soros, the man who's conducting so many dark conspiracies, is going to die, and then the world is going to become a utopia overnight.
Who knows?
Who knows? Dr. Ahmed, thank you so much. Where can people find your book?
So the book is now out and available. You can pretty much, it's been published only in the UK in paperback, but the great news is you can actually, wherever you are in the world, you can actually order the book directly from the publishers, from the website, which is alt-right.com. It is also available in all the good bookshops across the UK. You should be able to order it in as well. And it's available on most online platforms and bookstores all over the world. It's, you know, the ebook edition is available. I think in many parts, whether in the US or Europe, you can actually order it from online bookstores as well, and it will be shipped across. And we're working on getting it out there.
Awesome. Thanks again. I hope we get to do this again and in slightly better times.
Thank you so much, Zaza. I really appreciate it.
Please subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I've been told I have to say that, otherwise nothing happens. Weird. Also, if you feel like it, support me on Patreon. This is a one-person pod. I do everything myself. There's no team behind me, so please feel free to hop on Patreon and find Smart Cookies on there. And then last but certainly not least, I have to thank my existing patrons, Tovarishi and Tovarishitsa, you legends, you. Without you, there would be no pod. Which makes you actual producers of this show. So eternal thanks to Yush Premro, Nate Sirk, Goran Ivasic, Anže Sever, Ole, Marin Ferrara, Aljaš Maher, Strole, Aida, Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinho, Goran, Gordon, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronica, and Taichi. Seriously, I'm touched. Thank you so much.